Okay, we're going to walk and talk. Charlene, would you just, for the record, just quickly introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Charlene Lee. I am the External Relations Lead for IBM in ASEAN, and I'm going to be the tour guide for today.
Perfect. And I'm also here with Ken Mandel. Ken, quick introduction.
Hi, I'm Ken Mandel. I'm the head of Commerce and Innovation at Publicis Media.
And you'll find out in a minute why Ken is here. So we're going to get a tour of IBM's Watson Center, and we're going to stroll through. It's a huge open area. There's a coffee bar. You can probably hear the coffee in the background. People sitting around. Murals on the wall. It's a lab of sorts. They call it an incubator. But we're going to get a description of what that means. Okay.
This is Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. In this episode, we're at the IBM Watson Center in Singapore, and our topic is the evolution of social media and its implications in Asia Pacific. My guest is Ken Mandel, President of Innovation and Commerce at Publicis Media. That's a French-based multinational advertising and public relations company, and it's also one of the world's biggest. Ken is a digital industry veteran. Prior to his current role, he's been in leadership positions with a number of cutting-edge digital media and advertising firms, first as CEO and regional director for XM Asia Pacific, and later as CEO of Neo at Ogilvy in Singapore. He also helped establish and grow Yahoo in the region and served as the company's managing director for Southeast Asia. During his tenure, he opened for the erstwhile internet giant 4 new markets in less than 2 years. This is not a conversation you want to miss, but first, let's get back to Charlene Lee and our tour of the IBM Watson Center.
Okay, we now walk through from one end of the floor to the other, through a hallway, past a series of glassed-in rooms, lots of client meetings, lots of discussions. We now have a beautiful view of the Marina Bay Sands Hotel. It looks like a ship mounted on three towers. And this is the area where there's drawings on the glass. So is this the ideation area?
Exactly. This is the ideation area. It is also an inspiration zone. So occasionally when it's not booked out, we have our employees come in here, take a break, have a look out the windows, and really come up with the best ideas that they possibly can.
Okay. And this can be for startups, it could be for corporates.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. All right. So the size of the enterprise doesn't quite matter. The whole idea is that IBM is there as a partner to co-create the solution.
Okay, is this a new concept, something that's recently come? Because I recall IBM's been around this game for a while.
It's not necessarily new. It's the first time that we are verbalizing it. So this is the first time in this region, with this center, that we have all the different divisions of IBM coming together to really produce a holistic solution rather than working in silo.
All right. Now we're a series of whiteboards and sticky blues, greens, whites, and yellows all over the board. Lots of cartoon characters. And this is where people do their work after they come up with the idea, or this is where they actually do the work?
These are actually where they do the work. The whole idea with all of these pods is that it's completely mobile. Everything's portable, from the dividers, which act as whiteboards, to the types of screens that they use, to the size of space that is required. So depending on the number of teams and the number of solutions that are required for that particular client, the whole team comes together, sits together, and really creates that holistic solution.
Yeah, so you actually brought together three different kind of divisions in one. There's this design thinking, there's the Watson Lab, and then there's something else. There's a third component, which is more the consulting side. Is that right?
I don't think that is necessarily the way that we would be looking at this as a space.
Right.
Because based out of here, we actually have a number of different business units.
Okay.
We look at the IBM Center for Blockchain Innovation. We have IBM Garage for Bluemix and blockchain. We have the interactive experience teams, who are all based out here, and all of them work together in order to solve the problem.
So those are separate IBM divisions that have been set up to collaborate,
yes.
But they're actually run and operated as separate standalone divisions?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
So the whole idea here is that IBM stops being siloed.
Yeah,
so we stop.
Finally, that's great.
Yeah,
but we stop thinking of things as, you know, independent of each other.
Okay.
Everything is thought of as a holistic solution.
Mm.
So it's not just a case of, oh, you know, you want to move from something like hardware onto cloud. We got it.
Mm.
It's a case of, what is your core problem? How do we help you solve that?
Is there a classic example, like a case study that you talk about openly? One that's kind of gone soup to nuts, or you're still kind of more in the innovation phase and not something you're prepared?
One of the key examples would be out of Singapore, Singapore Airlines.
Okay.
Right? Out of Thailand, Siam Commercial Bank. So there are a number of case studies that have already been implemented and are in rollout phase.
Okay, great. Thanks. And what's this area we're standing in now?
This is IBM Research.
Okay.
So another component of what it is that we do, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, but IBM Research doesn't just work on technology. So we have, you know, the whole Zika virus research that we're into.
You started it.
Of course I did.
Oh, no. I knew it was from somewhere from Asia. It had to be.
Yeah. No, but this was actually something that it started with Brazil, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But we have research into many things that are essentially changing the way that we as humans live, function, interact, engage.
Okay.
And that's probably one of the most amazing things about IBM, because most people don't realize that.
Right.
You know, they see IBM as Big Blue.
Right.
That huge company that
yeah.
nobody can really relate to.
Yeah, mainframes.
Exactly.
Right.
But that's really not what we're about anymore.
Okay, so we've come full circle. We're back at the coffee shop. All right.
And there you have it. That is IBM Studios or the Watson Center at Marina Bay.
All right. So would you be good for us to just pull aside and have a conversation now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm here with Ken Mandel. We've just had a short tour and very short tour. Actually, we thought it would be a little longer, but I think everything is highly confidential. It is IBM after all, and that's fine. But here we are at the IBM Watson Lab in Singapore. This is IBM's most recent experiment in identifying business problems, working them through ideation, and applying technologies, both IBM's and others, as they see fit, in order to come out with a solution that could then be implemented in the market. They're trying to break down their structures, as you saw, and one of the most interesting aspects of IBM's new technology is their artificial intelligence branded Watson. So you'll know why we're here in just a minute, but the topic of today is really on the evolution of social media and its implications in Asia Pacific. And Ken Mandel is just the guy to talk about this subject. He's been in the region a long time. He's grown up with the whole evolution of social media in Asia. He's held a number of different jobs, which I'm going to have him briefly allude to. But for now, we're just going to gaze out the window and have a conversation. And Ken, we welcome you to the show.
Hey, Steve. I'm really happy to be here. And thanks for having me.
My pleasure. What actually brought you to Asia in the first place?
Yeah, I first came to Asia, probably not very surprisingly, as a backpacker in 1989. I toured through the region for about a year. And I remember said to a friend of mine I was traveling with, I said, I'd like to come back to Asia in a professional capacity, whatever that meant. You know, I was about 23 years old. So I went back to Canada and took a master's in Asian business, which did get me back to the region in a professional capacity.
What was the first job you got?
Teaching English, no. That's what I was trying to avoid, actually.
Not to teach English.
Yeah, because I was told by other folks who were teaching English that it's hard to get out of that job. You could start in that, but you may not be able to jump to another industry.
I recall that. I mean, most of the friends I knew were in Taiwan or Japan at the time teaching English, and it started to leak further south, Singapore and elsewhere.
Yeah. So I think for me, I made a conscious effort to take a degree in Asian business, which was quite interesting because it combined all your MBA subjects, but with a lot of cross-cultural communications, learning about religions, learning why, you know, certain cultures maybe have, you know, history with other cultures. So it really gave you the background that I still use to this day to lay a foundation.
So you came insensitized.
I did. Mm. I did. And I didn't come alone. You know, about 75% of my graduating class never went back to Canada. And we're still out here, you know, many, many years later.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So where did you first land when you came back to Asia?
In Bangkok in 1994.
Okay. I worked. Why Bangkok?
I felt that when I was backpacking, I learned a little bit of language, and Thai was the language I was picking up. So this course was very interesting because we had to actually specialize in one Asian language. Mm. So I chose Thai. Mm. and that's not very useful anywhere else but Thailand. Hindsight's always 20/20. Thai restaurants, it's quite useful at as well. And so I chose Bangkok, and I got my first job in public relations working for a company that Shanwick acquired called Presco, which was the kingdom's largest PR firm at the time.
And what did your job entail?
It was great. I first came in and I worked for the founder himself, Kun Esko, who was a Finnish missionary who moved to Thailand, I believe, in the late 40s, and then somehow reinvented himself as a PR practitioner and created the largest PR firm in Thailand.
Oh, interesting.
And so I worked with him. He hired me. Didn't tell anyone. I showed up in the office one sticky July, and nobody knew who I was. And I actually said I worked there, and they said, no, you don't. And then he came out into the hallway with a booming voice and said, oh, Ken, you're here, and took me away. And I spent the first few months kind of hanging with him, and then he put me into the general population of practitioners. And I ran, I was in financial PR, but because I had this aptitude for technology, they actually said, why don't you set up our first digital practice?
Yeah, which is very early on. I mean, they were talking about 1990, 91?
Yeah, so it wasn't actually called a digital practice back then. It was ICT, and so clients were all tech clients. So my first client was Intel, and then Nokia, when they first came into Thailand.
Yeah. And this is when all the mobile phone networks were starting to pop up, and the licenses were being distributed, and the country was leapfrogging from those kind of fixed line service networks.
It was going bananas, and it was, I remember sending the first text message. I didn't even know, like I said, it's an SMS, and I was like, what's that? Yeah. But in Thailand, nobody had mobile phones, and the traffic was so bad that they actually were a lifesaver, because if you were in traffic, you could call somebody. But I remember for the first year that I lived there, I didn't have a phone, and then it changed my life, being able to communicate.
Yeah. Did it start with pagers? Was it paging?
Yes. Yeah, PacNet was one of the paging companies, and then two-way pagers where you can send a few characters. Yeah, we've come a long way.
Yeah, and so at that time, so you figured, okay, there's something here. I mean, that there are different ways of using communication. So the idea of digital at that point was just using different channels in order to communicate?
I can tell you a very specific story, which is the email system we had couldn't handle attachments. And one day, the PR people from the States at Intel sent me an email saying, we're going to send you the press release as an attachment. We'd like you to print it and get it translated. And I was like, what? We have a fax machine. And they were like, no, we don't do that. And I said, oh, by the way, we need your letterhead, because we put all the press releases on letterhead, and then we send it out by motorcycle drivers that are on our staff. And they wrote back saying, why would you do that? Just black and white's fine. So this was like such modern thinking at that time. So I remember going to the IT guy and saying, I need to, accept an attachment, because it all came out as gobbledygook. It was, I don't know if you've ever opened up a Word file and it just looks like a bunch of characters. Right. That's how the email looked. Mm-hmm. So I had to actually find software to take that file and turn it back into a WordPerfect or whatever it was at that time.
Yeah, that's right. WordPerfect.
WordStar or WordPerfect. Yeah. And then I was like, wow, I'm really onto something now. I was the first person in the company to ever, use email that way.
So instead of direct mail, now you're thinking, okay, attachments to email, that's the future.
Attachments, and also just the fact that, I had just left Canada, where I had an email account with the school, but the only people I spoke to were the people I saw every day during the day. And I usually wrote emails at night, and we all had this little gang. We all lived in the same city, and we saw each other every day. And so it didn't seem very revolutionary. But then, each person in my program ended up somewhere in Asia, and we were still communicating. Some people were in Canada, and we were still communicating for free. And then I realized the penny dropped for me. Yeah. I was like, this is big. The distributed content, the ability to stay in touch, as far as Thailand to Canada, and it's the same cost as if I was in Vancouver.
And you were sitting in a part of the world where adoption of these types of new technologies and communications methods was hot across, a lot of Southeast Asia, particularly in Japan, I think, was a forerunner in terms of the development of their own, phones, early stage mobile phones, and some of the it was before the day of apps, but you could do some pretty kinky things with those phones, right?
I think the web exploded, it did nothing interesting up until about 1994, 95, and then it got very interesting, and then it got interesting again around 2004, that whole 2.0 thing. But you're right, Japan, when I would travel on business to Japan, I would always park at least 2 hours in my trip just to wander through the mobile phone shops. I got nothing but joy just looking at all the phones. I used to buy the dummies, you know, the ones that didn't have any, you know, circuitry in it, but they were the ones they displayed. And I used to buy the old ones just because I was so fascinated. And then iPhone came out and killed all that. Japan has nothing interesting because it's all generic. But in those days, the phones were so interesting. Yeah. And what was really interesting was flash on the mobile phone. That's what Japan had that no one else had.
Is that right? And that was back as early as 94, 95?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit later than that, though. It was probably 99 to 2000, and they had flash on the mobile phones.
I remember some of the keys were unique keys too. They weren't letters or characters or something. They had like, you know, click this and, you know, buy a video at your favorite store. Weird stuff.
Yeah, but they also were the first. You know, Docomo was the first company to share revenue with people creating what were essentially apps. That's what that whole sort of app economy came from. And the revenue split was decent. You know, there was a lot of telcos later in the region that kept the majority of the profit.
Yeah. And these were shared with kind of vendors, retailers, people who had, you know, product or services to sell.
Yeah, because with the way their app, I want to say app store, but it probably was called something else at that time, the best would rise to the top. So the ones that were downloaded the most would just become at the top of the list, kind of how an app store would work today.
Yeah. So it's fair to say, I mean, you were kind of like a little bit of the cutting edge in Asia when it came to this idea of digital communication and digitization, yeah?
Well, yeah, I think some people describe me as the Jehovah's Witness of technology because I'd go preaching it wherever I could and they would like shut the lights, lock the door. Ken's coming to tell us about the internet, you know, and nobody wanted to hear it back then.
Yeah. And how did you finally break through? You spoke louder than everybody else?
I guess I was just geeking out enough that I didn't really care what anyone else thought. I just kept going and people caught up, I guess.
And where'd you go? You went on to other agency roles after that, is that right?
Yeah, so I went on to WPP after that. Actually, WPP acquired the holding company that I was at. So I was at Bates and running this digital agency called XM, which was really the first big digital agency in the region. Mm. Did a lot of great work, even for folks like IBM and Singapore Airlines. We built the first e-commerce site.
Right.
But you know, after a while, as being the head of digital for this agency, digital was moving faster than my job, to the point where I felt that I couldn't learn and evangelize in the same role. I actually had to, you know, immerse myself in a culture that was purely all digital. So when Yahoo headhunted me out of Ogilvy and Mather to run Southeast Asia, I at first wasn't sure, and then I realized being in a pure digital culture would be good for me because I didn't have to spend any time evangelizing anymore on why digital was important.
So your job in many ways was translating what digital meant for clients instead of basically sitting and using it day in, day out as the primary.
Not just for clients, I was translating it for my colleagues as well at the time. To be fair, you know, it was 1% of the revenue at the time.
Right. And then Yahoo was on a tear at that point, or coming rising. It was on a rise, I guess I'd say, because it started basically to sprinkle, and it had innovations running market by market. They had every country for Yahoo, where Yahoo operated, has a different flavor. You walked into that environment.
I did, and I walked into something even better. I walked into markets where when the internet came, it was Yahoo, meaning that it was, you know, people's first email, first, you know, love in terms of internet technology. So when I would check in to a hotel in the Philippines or Jakarta, they would be like, oh, wow, do you have an extra card? And I'd be, oh, no, here's a pen. And a Yahoo pen, thank you. And it was like, I realized the brand was so strong, we could have sold sneakers.
Right. Right. And at some point, somebody probably thought about that.
I did, but yeah. I think that was a hard sell back to HQ. Ken wants to sell Yahoo Water.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest is social media insider Ken Mandel, and we're at IBM's Watson Center in Singapore. Our subject is the evolution of social media and its implications in Asia Pacific. Let's get back to our conversation. Now let's flash forward a little bit because, you know, the advent of social media and the idea that, you know, marketing was going from, as they say, above the line with lots of television advertising and billboards and buses and whatnot. And there were huge budgets had been dedicated across the world and in this part of the world as well to that type of above the line advertising. But then all of a sudden this thing came along where it said, you know, digital is pretty much where the eyeballs are. Lots of young people are coming up using their phones. They're being persuaded by their participation on Facebook or other type of social media environments. That shifted the landscape and advertising firms had to adjust. What did you notice at that time and what were some of the situations you found yourself in?
Well, I remember, you know, when Facebook first obviously was for Harvard students only, and then it went to other schools, and then it went public. You know, I got on, I guess, just a little bit after that. And the reason I was able to explore it so much is that I had just resigned from my advertising job to go to Yahoo. And, you know, I was on good terms with my employer at WPP. And they said, we'd like you to work out your full notice period. We'd like you to do some training, create some modules. So basically, I was on Facebook all day because I did the training, but, you know, it didn't take that long and the modules that I did. But I really explored Facebook. I was fascinated by it. And, you know, I was like, this is really, really interesting because people have always been social. I mean, you know, you would go to the cheese shop and you talk to the proprietor and say, can I try some cheese? And he'd give you some cheese. It was, you know, it's in our nature, right? Yeah.
You were getting cheese on Facebook? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I was cheesy on Facebook. Yeah. I remember the first status messages where it always be, Ken is, yeah. Ken, I would write those and I all the time, Ken is sleeping. And this is, you know, like 100 Z's in a row and stupid stuff like that.
You're the guy who started that.
Yeah. Maybe.
I hate you.
And so this exponentially just exploded in terms of technology, just digitizing the ability to be social. Mm. I mean, it is the most interesting thing a human can do is be social with another human.
But then how did you explain that to multinationals who are saying, no, sorry, we do television advertisements and we're fine paying $1 million for that ad and now we're going to distribute it and talk to all the movie channels to make sure that we're featured. I mean, how do you change that mindset or was it inevitable?
Well, I mean, when I first got onto Facebook, I didn't even think of it as a business application. It was just, you know, it was just social. And then later, this concept of earned, owned, and paid media. I mean, paid media was what you're talking about. That's what we did as agencies. People paid for the services, and they paid for the distribution. But this concept that a brand could be social with, you know, its prospects or customers was very interesting. And I think that's eventually what led me to go work with Buddy Media because it was a social CMS that allowed big multinational brands to have a social presence.
Explain that, CMS.
So content management system, you know, the content management system was around for many years before, but there wasn't a content management system for social. And, you know, there's more than one social platform. You know, you had Twitter, you have Facebook, Google Plus at the time, YouTube, now Snapchat. So what these CMSs did is they brought all of those different social networks together into one dashboard for the brand. Mm. Because what was happening was employees were saying, hey, I have the keys to the Facebook account. So I signed up with my own email and that's now like the IBM social media account. Mm. No, that doesn't work. It needs to be enterprise level. You need to have permissioning, you know, granular permissioning, depending on your level or role in the company. So this emerged as a new technology. It was a SaaS product, software as a service, grew very, very quickly because companies needed this because social was exploding and they didn't even have an enterprise solution to maintain it.
And then it was up around, 2009, 2010, where, you know, the ad revenue started to tip towards digital and away from traditional. What were some of the driving forces behind that? And maybe is there a story that you can recall of a client who said, okay, I guess, you know, we have no choice. The bus has left the station.
You know, for me, it was tipping before. But again, I was that, you know, evangelist ahead of my time where no one wanted to listen, where I could see it tipping. And the diagram I would always show or the chart was the amount of time people were spending on digital channels versus the amount of spend as an industry that we had. And it was a huge disparity. So the answer to that for me is you got to go where the consumer is. And the consumer was spending all of her time on social media or digital touch points. But we were not spending that as an industry. And it was inevitable that it would catch up. And that was the same for mobile, you know, where it was like everyone was on their mobile phone, but mobile ad spend was a pittance compared to, you know, desktop.
And wasn't there a case where at some point, you know, corporates in their budgets, they threw in with digital? I mean, they were going to do search on Google. They were going to do placements on these different networks. They were going to distribute whatever ad spend they had across these platforms. And then a few years go by and, you know, as we're looking at it now, the return on investment doesn't appear to have gelled.
Well, that's interesting. That's, you know, goes back to, I believe, Mark Pitchard of Procter & Gamble's recent comments, which are very interesting. But I think before we get there, we have to look at where companies like Procter & Gamble or Unilever were, you know, a few years back, where they had to mandate that their brand managers spent X percent on digital because it just wasn't getting spent. And they realized there was a learning curve. So you were a brand manager and part of your KPI was to spend 10% of your budget on digital.
Yeah.
Well, you know, interesting. I mean, that's not that hard to achieve, but it was scary.
Yeah.
And so now I think what happened is maybe, you know, some people feel like it's been overdone.
Yeah, the pendulum swung too far the other way.
Yeah, and there obviously there needs to be accountability. One of our competitors announced that they were pulling all their advertising because an ad appeared programmatically, which programmatically means basically it's machines trading ads, mm-hmm. and it automatically appears beside content that unfortunately was not, let's say, brand centric content.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I'm not saying it was a porn site, but it was something. Yeah. Not appropriate, and that caused an issue.
Yeah, and here we go, and this is why we're sitting here at the IBM Watson Lab, because we're at a moment at an inflection point where artificial intelligence is now being overlaid on social media applications and capabilities, and it doesn't always necessarily get the result you're looking for, and also it starts to challenge aspects of privacy, which are obviously a big deal in a lot of countries around the world.
I think with social media, parents, you know, I was, my kids were a bit young at the time, but I was thinking like, you know, there's other kids who are writing things and showing pictures that they will regret later in life when they go to get their first job. What's a famous swimmer? Was it Michael Phelps? There was a picture of him like doing a bong hit or something, right? Which could really affect your
yeah.
sponsorship.
He's a good swimmer.
He is.
Yeah.
Good lungs.
Yeah.
And so, even then, we kind of knew that there was a bad idea. And I mean, maybe that's why Snapchat became popular, because it disappeared. Mm. You know, recently went public. And so there was obviously an appetite for that. But let's face it, most of us are not using Snapchat exclusively, even millennials. So there's a lot of residual social media data out there. And I think before AI emerged, it'd be impossible for someone to comb through it with any sort of intelligent filter.
Yeah.
But with artificial intelligence, it is possible.
Yeah, and artificial intelligence is you know, if you were to say artificial intelligence is to the Boeing 747 what data is to jet fuel, right? It's the idea, mm-hmm. it's what drives it. And every AI application needs data, and the kind of data that's been pooled and developed and accrued over years through the Facebooks and other social media platforms starts to cause some concern. So there's some extraordinary benefits that come from that, but there are also some reservations and some concerns that adjoin it.
I think we've always had too much data. We generate a huge amount of data and we had no way to make it actionable. I believe that AI helps us on that quest to make the data actionable in a way that didn't exist previously.
Mm. They're all investing though. I mean, Facebook launched a new research lab dedicated to advancing the field of AI. Google acquired DeepMind, a company built on learning algorithms. You know, what else you've got? LinkedIn has made its largest single acquisition has been with a group called Bright, a company that focuses on data and algorithm-driven job matches. Pinterest is in there looking at kind of the way that visual graphics can be basically tracked. So they know that there's power in data, and they clearly have the commercial and the financial capability to exploit and explore this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I saw an interesting chart on a site that I like a lot called The Information, where Google has outspent their competitors almost 2x on AI acquisitions, a lot more than anyone else.
So now it's a matter of figuring out for all those other organizations out there, companies that collect data on a regular basis. It could be airlines, it could be travel agencies, it could be any of the aggregators that are basically collecting commercial transactions, banks. They all have access to data, and now the question is, in the age of programmatic, how will they use and design these applications to deliver information to people, and will it undermine our very political systems that we lean on and depend on?
Well, I think it's from a speed perspective, it changes the game. Things can happen much faster. So imagine a customer service call. You don't need to be asked all these questions about, what your email is, what's the last transaction you did. Your bank can identify you now through your voice, and then obviously with some data processing. But also, you may not have to speak to a human being, and therefore you don't have to wait on hold to begin with, because the AI can get you to a certain point in your customer query. So it really is about processing data. I think AI is about obviously several things. I mean, there's AIs that can beat you in chess, bringing us back to Watson or Jeopardy, right? But those are narrow AIs. Mm. What we're going to get to obviously is a stage where AI can match. Is that the Turing test where you can't tell if you're speaking to a computer or a human? We'll get there fairly soon. It's scary, actually.
One of the things, just thinking back on Asia Pacific, some of the concerns that constrained in some ways the distribution of films or media or programs was around censorship. One of the concerns in many countries in this part of the world is personal data privacy. And so a lot of governments are doing or reaching out and trying ways of blocking this if they can. In other cases, there's situations like in China where they're advocating and actually looking to some of their big companies like Baidu. I recently heard about something called the Citizen Score, which is something that Baidu is working on, where they're kind of collecting data on everybody who's on social media platforms and then creating, almost guidelines in terms of how Chinese citizens can be approved for loans or receive a job or be approved for overseas travel with a visa. That's a scary 1984 scenario we're looking at here, yet the quality and efficiency and speed with which people will be approved is off the charts.
Yeah, I mean, there's a dark side to this, and of course there's a white side. Yeah. The white side is that you can get something approved quickly. Mm. The dark side is obviously China has a history of collecting data on dissidents and then, taking action on that. Mm. That was an issue in my time at Yahoo, where there was a dissident that was arrested because of data that was given up. And it's very unfortunate. Imagine what happens, though, when that's all, powered by AI.
Yeah. Well, Ken, that's why you've now gone through the evolution, and you've watched this at every level, at every stage. You work with clients day in, day out on these subjects and trying to understand the power and the promise and the risks associated with social media. A friend of mine wrote a book called it was something to the effect of AI, Our Final Invention, where he was talking about this being our 1936, and we've just split the atom, and we have no idea on the consequences. Will we light up the world, or will we light up the world? And that's the decision point we're at with AI. I mean, as we release these bots or these little elements into our databases to go and scroll and search and interpret and then feedback information, it does feel a little bit daunting.
Yeah, I think we are at a major inflection point. But just to back up a little bit on your point about Asia and privacy, Asia never had the privacy legislation in place, right? Yeah. All the reasons around Asia was going back to our earlier point around collecting information about people that may say something bad about the government. So censorship, basically. But it was never there like the way it is in Europe. So that means that it's the Wild West for AI bots potentially in this part of the world.
So you're saying there's actually fewer restrictions on the books and therefore greater opportunity to experiment?
Yeah, which, you know, again, could be good or bad. I mean, there may be much more innovation around AI and social media happening out in Asia because you don't have those privacy laws, where in Europe you're heavily restricted, and in North America somewhere in between. And there, you know, let's also not forget that over 50% of the world's social media traffic happens in Asia, and pretty much over 50% of everything digitally happens in Asia. I mean, e-commerce as well, mobile phone penetration, and largely India and China drive a big part of that. But if you just wanted to compare it on a data basis, obviously there's more data to mine in Asia with less privacy restrictions than anywhere else on the planet.
You know, we're sitting here, and this is they refer to this Watson Center as an incubator, where they bring, you know, clients of all sizes, shapes into this spot, from startup to large corporates, to help them kind of ideate and create and blueprint, you know, out what they want to achieve. I mean, what do you think about the prospects for these types of incubators, which is a little bit of a different spin from, you know, the startup incubators we had of maybe a decade ago that were there to kind of help encourage and prop up, if you will, some of the early stage investments that venture capitalists were making?
Yeah, I think though it stems from that, and you know, I think it's corporates wanting to get a little bit of that sort of startup blood, and so the way those startup, you know, incubators operated was, like you said, to take a nascent startup and help shape it. So they've taken some of those elements, they've put it with, you know, agile methodology to really help you move faster. It is a little bit of a flavor of the month, I think, in terms of corporates wanting to act like startups or even working with startups. But I think it's the right thing to do, because you can't just work within your corporate walls.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of failure out there. I mean, you know, when, as we're speaking with our clients, a lot of them have gone down these kind of digital pipes and come out the other and realized, well, I spent a lot of money, but I didn't get a lot of value. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thinking as to why that might be. You know, failure is something that the Asian companies and organizations and individuals don't always do well with. Can you comment on that a bit?
I mean, it's cultural in the sense that, you know, in America, especially in Silicon Valley, and maybe this is why Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley, you know, failure is a badge that says, you know, you've learned something. You know, it's that classic, when I interview someone, you want to hear about their failures, because that means they probably won't make that mistake again when they work for you. And in Asia, obviously, that's not just Asia, even in Eastern Europe, I believe as well, but that is not something you go and talk about too much. Although, who knows, maybe these innovation centers will allow people to share more. And I think there's something conducive about bringing people out of their own corporate walls to a neutral spot and allowing them to you know, iterate in an environment where you see other teams. So when you walk around here, you see all the stickies and the whiteboards, and you feel like something is going on. There's a lot of brain power happening. It's a good feeling.
So it's as much about the atmosphere as it is the processes behind it.
Absolutely. And the silos are not, you know, only and departmental, there also could be physical, the way an office is laid out. If you look at around here, it's all, there's no walls. But there's walls you can bring in to kind of set up a temporary room, but then they're just mantled again.
Ken, thank you so much for taking the time. I hope you know, the data collected on you works in your favor, and we hope to be here 10 years from now having similar conversation.
Or it'll be AIs having that conversation. But thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to talking again.
This is Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. That was my conversation with digital innovator Ken Mandel on the premises of the IBM Watson Center in Singapore. For more information, to download our other episodes, and for links to articles on the potential dangers of social media and the growth of AI, head to www.insideasiapodcast.com. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.